Story of Mephibosheth tonight. It is one of the reasons I believe that the statement is made about David. He was a man after God's own heart. Because we see in David's actions the heart of God in this situation. I appreciate Jeff reading that very tough passage with all those wonderful names. It is a beautiful and touching story. Before we look at 2 Samuel 9, I want to get into the backstory a little bit, because the backstory, as in so many other cases, helps us to appreciate the richness and power of David's actions here. Before David was king, his relationship with the house of Saul was conflicted, to say the least. It wasn't all bad, actually, but it was definitely conflicted. Saul, of course, wants to kill David, and gives frequent expression to that desire. In 1 Samuel 18, 8 and 9, it says, "Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And he said, 'They have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?' So Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on." And so that's kind of the slaying of Goliath and the song that resulted as the beginning of Saul's intense paranoia with regard to David. In 1 Samuel 18:11, Saul hurled a spear at David, and we're told that he is thinking, "I will pin David to the wall." But David escaped from his presence. And again in 1 Samuel 23:14, we're told that David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds and remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day. Saul was relentless in his pursuit of David. And he continued to try and kill David until finally in 1 Samuel 27:4, David flees to Gath and dwells among the Philistines. David's relationship with Jonathan was very different than that of his relationship with Jonathan's father, Saul. We're told in 1 Samuel 18 and verse 1, it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. This is the conflicted part. So on the one hand, you have Saul, who has this intense hatred and paranoia with regard to David. And on the other hand, we have this incredibly close friendship, this brotherhood that exists between Jonathan and David. We're told in 1 Samuel 19:1 that Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death, but Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. And it's out of this situation and Jonathan's knowledge that David is the anointed king that they enter into a covenant together before David flees from the presence of Saul. In 1 Samuel 20, 12 through 17, Jonathan says to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness." And so this is an oath formula. He is calling God as his witness. "When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow, or the third day, behold, if there is good feeling toward David, shall I not send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan, and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety." Now, again, notice there's an oath formula in that. And basically what Jonathan is saying is, if my father wants to harm you and I don't tell you, may the harm he intended for you be brought upon me by God. And so he takes this very strong oath and he says, "David, if it's good, I'm going to tell you. If it's bad, I'm going to tell you. I've got your back." And And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. He goes on to say, if I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Now, we'll touch on this later in the lesson, but the tradition is when a new dynasty comes in, that the safest course is for the new dynasty to get rid of the old dynasty. And they didn't put them in witness protection back then. They just, you know, got rid of them. And so Jonathan is saying, you know, when God destroys all your enemies, could you maybe spare me, given our relationship? And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. And so David and Jonathan have made a covenant, and basically the covenant entails David not cutting off Saul's house, and particularly Jonathan's descendants in particular are protected under this covenant. Now, a strict understanding of the covenant doesn't go much further than that. It simply suggests that David is not going to do what is normal and get rid of them. He's going to show them loving kindness and sparing their life. And so with that in mind, let's turn our attention to 2 Samuel 9, 1 through 13. And I want to kind of crunch through this and just make some general observations. We're not going to go into a whole lot of depth here, but I want to make some general observations about what happens. Then David said, is there anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now, notice right away that we're getting a sense of magnanimity on David's part, because he doesn't say, are there any of Jonathan's descendants left? Which is what he had kind of obligated himself to. But he says, anybody in Saul's house that I can show some loving kindness to? Is there anybody out there? And so his intent is kind of bleeding over into anybody in Saul's house that he might show loving kindness to. And he finds out that there is. We're told in verse 2, there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, I am your servant. The king said, is there not yet anyone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? And Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan who is crippled in both his feet. So the king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, behold, he is in the house of Maker, the son of Amiel, in Lodabar. Okay, so not exactly sure where this is. It is to the east of the Jordan. So it's the other side of the Jordan from Jerusalem. Probably in the land of Gad. The name Lodabar is interesting. It is used in Amos chapter 6 in verse 13 as in contempt. And it means not a pasture or nothing. And so, there's a member of Saul's house, a son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth, and he's crippled in both his feet, so he doesn't really bring anything to the table. And he's hiding out in the middle of nowhere. And it kind of sounds like maybe not destitute, but he's hiding out in the middle of nowhere with nothing. He's out there in the emptiness, on the fringes, crippled. And David said, yeah, bring him. Bring him. And the king sent and brought him from the house of Maker, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar. Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and prostrated himself. Now, I want us to stay, I know I stopped in the middle of the verse, but I want us to stay in this moment for just a moment. Think about this. It looks like Mephibosheth has been hiding. And he gets a summons from the king. He has to travel down there, and he falls down in front of the king. He is the grandson of the man who had relentlessly pursued David to kill him. Now, he probably knew that Jonathan and David are friends, but in that world and at that time, that's probably not enough. And this man, in all likelihood, believes that he is about to die. He is done for. And here's what happens. David said, "Mephibosheth." And he said, "Here is your servant." David said to him, and we get a hint here, because David's first word, David knows what Mephibosheth is probably feeling. And so David's first words to him are, "Do not fear, for I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan, and will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly." Now see, he's out in the middle of nowhere, hiding in a place called Not a Pasture, whatever that means. And David brings him out and he says, "You know all your father's lands? You get them all back. You get them all back. They're all yours. But food is not really going to be an issue for you anymore, because you sit at my table with my sons and you eat my food from now on." Now, Saul is gone. Jonathan's gone. And Mephibosheth really doesn't bring a lot to the table here as the crippled grandson of an ex-hated king with nothing. And David gives him everything, because he made a promise not to harm Jonathan's family. This is quite a do no harm. You get all your father's property. You sit at my table. You enjoy everything that my sons enjoy. You sit under my roof. He is granted table fellowship with the king. Again, he prostrated himself and said, "What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me?" You know, that's interesting language. David used similar language about himself when Saul was trying to kill him. But that's not what's going on here. The king called Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him. You shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in the house of Ziba were servants to Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly. Now he was lame in both his feet. Now, you notice there are a couple of things that the text keeps telling us over and over again. And one of those things is that Mephibosheth is lame in both his feet. He's not. You know, David doesn't bring him in because he's going to be, you know, a replacement for one of the mighty men. And you know, he's not going to step into Uriah's spot or something later on. It's not going to happen. The other thing that's said over and over again is he eats at the king's table regularly. And I think about this imagery because later on in passages like Isaiah 55, salvation will be presented as a feast that is set before us by the Lord. And just like Mephibosheth, God has brought us into His kingdom and given us a spot at the table, even though we all come crippled in both our feet. We don't bring anything to the table. Hey, Lord, how would you like a drunk and a liar with a mohawk and a bad attitude? But God said, you will eat from my table regularly with my sons. Now, I want to kind of flip this around and I want to look at it from Mephibosheth's perspective. He describes himself. He's fully aware that he has nothing to offer David. He can't pay him back. He can't earn his keep. He can't. And so he says, I'm just a dead dog. And we need to understand that even after the death of Saul, there had been a protracted war between the house of David and the house of Saul, that Mephibosheth had, for all intents and purposes, been under a death sentence. In 2 Samuel chapter 3, in verse 1, it says, now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. Mephibosheth was on the losing side. And again, if you go over to 1 Kings 15, you get an idea of how being on the losing side usually ended. In 1 Kings chapter 15, in verse 28, it says, so Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. And it came about as soon as he was king, he struck down all the household of Jeroboam. He did not leave to Jeroboam any persons alive until he had destroyed them according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. Now, God prophesied of that. Yes, he instructed that. But Baasha wasn't doing that because he was trying to please God. Trust me. If you doubt, go ahead and read in 1 Kings. But trust me, Baasha was not thinking, ooh, how can I please? Oh, I'll kill all these people and that'll make God happy because he said it was going to happen. No, that wasn't it. He's getting rid of rivals. And that's how they rolled. And so Mephibosheth was destined for judgment, which is probably why he's in the house of the son of Maker in Lodabar, hiding out. The house of Saul came under just punishment later in David's reign. You may remember that during Saul's reign, he had decided that he was going to wipe out the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites were a people in Joshua 9 that had, through a deception, tricked the people of Israel into making a covenant with them. And they had become hewers of wood and carriers of water. They could become servants with regard to the tabernacle and presumably later the temple. But Saul decided he's going to get rid of the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites cried out to God, and God pronounced a judgment on the household of Saul. But we're told that when that happened in 2 Samuel 21:7, the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath of the Lord, which was between them, between David and Saul's son Jonathan. It wasn't a sort of a flash in the pan kind of gracious act. David remained mindful of Mephibosheth, cared for him, protected him. And there's another interesting interchange later on between Mephibosheth and David, and it's not exactly clear, at least in my mind, it's not exactly clear everything that happened, but there are a couple of things I think are dead clear. David had to flee from his son Absalom, and when he was fleeing, Mephibosheth's servant Ziba came out, and he said, "Oh, Mephibosheth thinks he's going to get his place back, and he's looking for that." But when David returns, Mephibosheth comes out to David, and an interesting thing happens. David confronts Mephibosheth, with Ziba's story. And David essentially decides that he's going to take Saul's inheritance and he's going to divide it up between Mephibosheth and between the household of Ziba. Notice what Mephibosheth says in 2 Samuel 19:28. "For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king?" And then if you drop down to 2 Samuel 19 and verse 30, when David suggests dividing the land between Mephibosheth and Ziba, or Mephibosheth says to him, "Let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house." Now, I want you to think about that, because what Mephibosheth says is, you know, I don't care about the land. If I can sit at your table again, none of that matters. He declares his loyalty and devotion to the king. Now, with that story in mind, I just want to read one more passage, and the lesson will be yours. In Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 6. "For while we were still helpless, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than having now been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through Him. Mephibosheth knew what it was to be helpless. And he knew what it was to be saved from the wrath of God. Paul continues, "If while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of His Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by His life. And not only this, but we also exult in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received the reconciliation." And that is exactly what Mephibosheth does in that last account. He exults in his relationship with his king and his benefactor, his deliverer, David. I am Mephibosheth. And so are you. God sent His Son into the world to die. So that you could sit with His children in table fellowship. We were, or we are, all of us, broken and living in Lodabar, an empty place of alienation. We've all either been there or we're still there. That's our story. And our King has brought us back. Or He longs to. If you have not been brought back by the great David, Jesus Christ, the one who sits on the throne to show loving kindness, we would echo the call of our King and call you to Him. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, render obedience to the gospel. Come and turn away from your sins, confess your faith, and be baptized. And as for the rest of us, let us remember the magnitude of what our King has done. The greatness of the loving kindness that has been shown each one of us, even when we were broken and in a far off and empty place. If you need to obey the gospel tonight, come now as we stand and as we sing.